Tonight's is the second talk in the series Suffering and Its Cause. And the next four talks, including tonight, will be on the cause. We covered the fact of pain and contraction and suffering and struggle. And we'll keep bringing that component up as we talk about the causes, of course. But the Buddha had talked about three different expressions that desire takes. And for the next three talks after this one, I will talk about those specifically. And they are desire for sense objects, desire for existence, and the third is the desire for non-existence. But unless we understand desire itself, unless we understand the broad brushstroke of what desire is, then looking at the specifics of desire or where it embodies itself really isn't so much the point. It's not so much the point of what I'm desirous of, much more the point of what the quality of mind is and how the mind configures itself when it's desiring. And so tonight has to do with that setup, that configuration, and then we'll move off into the specifics of how it configures or towards what it configures in the subsequent parts of this series. But I just want to sort of tie up some loose ends from the first talk because I realized that I kept talking about going towards the difficult or going towards pain and not about necessarily the pain that's caused when there's a pleasure or pleasant event, a pleasant experience. And if you train yourself just to go to the unpleasant experience, that's fine. But equal pain can result, equal contraction can result in the pleasant experiences as well. That we can hold on, of course we do hold on, to the pleasant because we want it to last longer. We want the duration to be continuous. And it's, of course, defied by the fact that it's in transition and becomes affected by change over time so that it's impossible to sustain a pleasant experience. But if you look at how we contract and struggle to make that happen, you can see that is the result, that is a result of difficulty or pain right there. And then, of course, how we disapprove or revolt or move back from an unpleasant experience. There's also a contraction around that. So it's not the component of whether the experience is pleasant or unpleasant that we need to address, but rather how we're contracting to sustain one and to limit the duration of the other. That's the pain. That's the pain that we should go to. That's the difficulty we want to seek out. And we can very easily miss the unpleasant aspects, the contraction around the unpleasant ones, because we don't really want to bother the unpleasant one with our attention. And it seems to intrude upon the enjoyment we have with something when we pay attention to having a pleasant experience. Have you ever noticed that? Try eating mindfully sometime. And you can't quite indulge as much in the taste and pleasure and comfort of the food as you can when you're mindless. But nevertheless, there's something going on there that needs your attention. So, it's not so much the nature of the experience, it's our relationship to the nature of that experience that is the problem. So I hope everybody sort of understands that, because it's an important point. So now we're going to take up the second noble truth, and the second noble truth is really the study of how we make ourselves miserable. Isn't this fun? In the, I think of the Tao Te Ching, it talks about the that The secret waits for eyes unclouded by longing. The secret waits for eyes unclouded by longing. Or stillness waits for the mind that's in repose and relaxed with life, rather than leaning into that life, rather than yearning through the yearning aspect itself. And so really what we're talking about is a kind of unconscious longing that drives our lives for most of our years on the earth, and that it remains an unconscious motivator to much of our activity. And let me say that I'm speaking not just about desire here, but also fear, because they're really one and the same thing. When you're desiring something, you're fearing the alternative. And when you're fearing something, you're desiring relief from that sense of insecurity. So that sense of desire and fear are really coupled at the hip. And I think that's why the Buddha didn't mention fear specifically in the Second Noble Truth. So that sense of fear and desire being one and the same thing, and that it's just the perception of that moment, and whether it's an aversive state or a pleasurable one, as to which one of those protrudes and manifests and we pay attention to. And desire is that sense that something's missing in my life. Something is lacking. Something is just, there's a sense of incompletion about my relationship to my living experience. And as we live with that for a long enough period of time, it can come out in completely unconscious ways, like envy and jealousy, complaint, a multitude of byproducts of kind of a sort of a continuous yearning that we live with in our life, and that longing. Sometimes the longing can couple itself with life itself, so it conditions itself to life, to the fabric of life, so that we don't even realize anymore what we're longing for, what we're desirous of. It can kind of be the white noise, the white background noise of something. And it feels like it's not specific any longer. It can just be coupled up with a kind of a sense of how we relate to the world, as if there's something missing even when we wake our eyes up in the morning. And it's the activity that I find myself in that demonstrates that most apparently to me is when I go to the refrigerator and just open it. And you look around at the different drawers, and there's just, you're just standing there because there's nothing that you really want. In fact, when I look at the activity, I'm not even hungry. It's just that's where my mind goes for some degree of satisfaction against this lingering wanting in the background. So we need to get a sense of how it drives us in its subtlety, in its non-specific way. But there's something I really want to focus in on right now, and that is whether, does this desire lead to happiness? Because that's what we're trying to do. The conclusion is that if we chase after what the mind says we need, then when we obtain it, there will be satisfaction. And the mind thinks that satisfaction could potentially be continuous. It could be the thing that I need in my life for fulfillment, like relationship or whatever we might be have chased for a long period of time, only to find that when you've obtained it, more struggle and contraction comes often in the obtainment of it. And I think most fundamentally we need to ask ourselves, is desire working towards what its job is, which is to provide contentment? I mean, is it working? Because if it's not working, we should fire it. Make it unemployed. Because it contradicts its reason for being. Its reason for being is to establish a contentment, a fulfillment, a sense of wholeness. And of course, it doesn't. But again, I want to ask whether each of us know that in its depth. We so easily pass over these minor, often repeated Dharma points, like desire doesn't lead to happiness. And we dismiss it, whitewash the more refined way that we continue desiring, or we wouldn't desire if we really saw that in depth. So these talks, although fundamental in quality, are not fundamental in simplicity. They are deep and profound. And if you begin to really see that this desire, force of desire, is not going to lead to fulfillment, then you essentially understand that the payoff is never going to be what it seems to be. In fact, you begin to see that it's the mind trying to impersonate the heart. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean the heart seeks fulfillment not in the things of the world, but in a deeper rest than what the world can provide. But the mind, because it doesn't have any other resources than to try to think its way into fulfillment, it uses thought in the form of desire or fear to navigate to that same sense of fulfillment. And of course, when we navigate with the desire or the fear through life, we cut ourselves off from the deeper fulfillment and longing of the heart. And so it's the mind trying to impersonate that deep sense of longing for completion that bubbles up through the heart. And it does it in a very distorted and limited way. But we just keep believing that it'll happen. We just keep believing if we just keep doing this thing long enough, somehow this desire will pay off like other ones haven't in the past. Instead of just, it's not working. Period. That's it. No more chitter-chatter here. You know, no more obeying the dictates of a failed system. It's failed. How many more chances do we have to give it? How many? But we need to know what it promises and why we keep biting the bit of that promise. We need to know that. Because to understand what it promises, we can begin to see whether those promises are fulfilled. And one of those, of course, is what I just mentioned. It promises fulfillment. Okay, we can see that one. Every time we move with desire, we can see that the fulfillment may be temporary. Maybe temporarily we are fulfilled. Satiated is what we mean by fulfillment. We've had enough chocolate. That's what we mean. I don't want the chocolate anymore. But what about a second or two later when the mind's off in another direction? So what is it that what does the desire seem to promise? Well, it seems to promise me hope, doesn't it? It seems to point to a better future. And we love that because as a culture, we like to think of ourselves as improving. And so if something promises improvement from the status quo, we will ride that horse very quickly. And through that hope, it also establishes life's meaning. You see? We get a lot out of it. We get a sense of the purpose of why we live. Not just on the individual and idiosyncratic wants of chocolate or, you know, that sort of sensual desire, but these deep embedded yearnings that we have for family, for relationship, for education, for these things that we think fundamentally will give us not only hope, but also a posture and purpose for life and an intentionality and a resolve. It will give us a kind of a complete package where we can perhaps live happily ever after like the fairy tales. It also gives us the power, a personal power, to derive our own fantasies. It's tremendously powerful, the mind, and what it can work and escape to, and what it can pursue, and how it can hold the world in terms of that pursuit. It really feels musculature, especially when we feel so perhaps impotent and powerless in our life, or unacknowledged or invalidated. Then to have a rich fantasy life, to have one that can move with the whim of my greatest fantasy, like Walter Mitty, and no longer be coupled or having to stay in the mundane and ordinary. So it's a mechanism, it's a means out of the ordinary. And as I've mentioned before, this culture means anything. It means rising above the ordinary. And perhaps none of us can do that except through our fantasies, because it's not livable for all of us to be above average. Let's see. You feel that? So desire gives us much more than just the pursuit of a candy bar. It gives us a whole relationship and enticement to life itself. So this is tremendously powerful. If it were just a candy bar, we could be out of it in no time. Or some of us could. But because the richness of the depth of promise is such, and what it holds us to in terms of who we are in a meaningful way on this earth, then it has a deeper embedded truth that we allow it to have. So that's the payoff, so to speak, the power of it. And we have to honor, and we have to get to know that, and we have to see that in ourselves. And then I say we also need to know what it can't provide, where it takes us into tragedy and difficulty and disaster. We have to understand that. And we have to watch both of those. And we have to watch the weight of each of those. And we have to see how we still pursue this, not denying the advantages that it gives us, but neither denying the contraction and difficulty and pain that surfaces with it also. We have to hold both of those, and we have to look and be willing to look honestly at that, not whitewashing either one. Whitewash either one, and you have reactivity, and you have tension, but you don't have understanding. You have being righteous in my desire, I'll be desireless. Then you have the ascetics. Asceticism. But you don't have understanding. So you have to understand. This whole thing opens up through the field of understanding. Understanding what desire is. Looking at it. Okay, let's look at that thing. I remember early on in my practice being a chocolate-holic. I would take a piece of very fine chocolate and I'd put it right on the dashboard of the car and I would drive with it. And then I was just, you know, and then you stop at the light. And, I mean, at any time it's reachable. But I just play with it a little bit. Just let the enticement be in there. But because my will was not so strong, it would usually last till about 2 stoplights. That's okay. Just playing with it. Just allowing it to surface. Allowing that to be seen and felt. And rather than having to be impulsive about it and to feel how the mind works and to feel the pain of it. And that's what I want to talk about now is the difficulty, is the contraction that desire creates. And if you'll reflect back to the talk on pain and suffering, that there were 3 types of pain I spoke about. And as we go through the pain of desire, you can hear those 3 types within desire itself. One being the pain of just having desire, the pain of having a desire. You think it's pleasurable, maybe, but look at it. It's agitating. It's not pleasurable. Pleasure comes in the fantasy of the goal, not in the actual having of the desire. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. And then there's the pain of the pain of what's driving the desire. What's driving this desire? And we'll talk about that. And then there's the pain of the ultimate separation from the world that desire must take. In order to take a piece of the world, you have to separate the world out from yourself. And so there's an existential pain, a pain of separation, that is also crucial for us to understand if we're going to solve this puzzle of desire. So let's look at the first pain, the pain of what drives desire. And I'd like to just, as I often do, but I think it's very important to do, is to look at the cultural antecedents, how that culture sets us up to be inducted into desire from a very early age. And we don't have to be too shrewd or astute to see that this economy runs on our need to want. Right? And so the quicker it can induce wanting in us, the better off the economy is. It's not interested in being conscious. It's interested in the unconscious longing that it can stimulate in you, because that drives the wheel of the whole machinery. The downside of that is that when we live with a kind of longing and a wanting, and it becomes from the specific, I want this or that, and however many ads we see per day over the course of our lifetime, it no longer loses its specificity and becomes a non-specific. It becomes inward poverty, a kind of longing that has no specific outlet. But how we have embraced ourselves and how we hold the image of ourselves. And then the longing has taken its rightful ownership of being an assumed sense of myself. Because that's ultimately where the market wants to drive it. But it also, remember, wants you to stay unconscious of that motivating factor for your activity. Because when you can stay unconscious, you won't look at it itself. You will react to that longing and to that self-misery and look for temporary satisfaction through obtaining the different products that life has to offer. But again, it must be unconscious. And so there's never relief in sight. If it did, the economy would fall flat and you would just have one thing. See, it knows, the economy knows that a certain thing isn't going to satisfy you. It knows that, or it would be a one-product economy. You see, it knows it's establishing the jungle gym relationship of bar, 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 one thing leading to the next. We have to know this in ourselves. We have to see it when it's being induced. All the commercials and all of the, see, from that sense of self insufficiency, which is where the self configures around the wanting, how it configures around the wanting, that sense of insufficiency, it just yearns for some relief to its own inward pain. Something that can soothe it out of that. And so naturally, it's going to move towards the pleasurable. It's not going to move towards the unpleasurable. That's what it feels about itself. It's going to move towards the pleasurable, and however it defines the pleasurable, to give it some relief, to give it some respite from this nagging, ongoing longing that drives the wanting, that stimulates the wanting, that encourages the wanting, that motivates the wanting, the specific wanting. That sense of inward deprivation We can begin to condition into life itself. If you look at yourself, and you have to look at yourself with some degree of impersonalization, or you won't ever want to do this. Because when you look at yourself, often we feel deprived, no matter what the outward situations are, no matter how much we have, no matter how fulfilling our life seems to have become, and the standards of our time, we still feel kind of underprivileged. That's not your fault. You've done nothing wrong. That has been conditioned into how the mind holds life. See, it's life's failings, or we can make it my failings. My failings, I've become discouraged and kind of self-implode. On life's failings, I become cynical and angry. And then there can be this ongoing anxiety from this as well. So we carry a kind of life angst with us, that we won't get our share, we won't get enough. I remember, you know, being in a large family. There were seven total, five children. And we were middle class, but we weren't anything more than middle class. And we would have enough food, but barely enough. I've always had a high metabolism, and I seemed like I needed more than everybody else, but I was never served more than anyone else. And I would approach the dinner table with this kind of anxiety and panic, knowing that, you know, I really, that my desires were going to be undermined. I wasn't going to get what I really, the satisfaction I really wanted from the food. I would go from the table often hungry. That sort of anxiety. And now the food can come. We have plenty of food. There can be this continued conditioned anxiety around food. Anyway, it continues. Not so much now, but I remember well into my 20s and long after I had left home. Just because it's no longer relevant to the situation, but the mind doesn't care. It's found its groove in that anxiety. It's found its reality in that anxiety. It doesn't matter if it fits the outward appearance of things at all. And that self-image, the pain of the moment, and seeking the pleasurable response to alleviate that sense of self-image, that anxiety, to be able to put down the burden. You see, when we seek pleasure, pleasure represents more than itself. When we carry a painful self-image, it represents respite from the self-image, the pain of inadequacy, the pain of self-discouragement. So my seeking pleasurable objects in the form of chocolate or anything else, the specificity of the desire, means more than the attainment of that one thing. It means relief from the self-image as well. See how powerful this is? Get a sense of how powerful this is. We're not playing here. We're playing with fire. It's that dangerous. But we're children playing with fire. And the more we can look outward to sort of settle that sense of inadequacy, the less we have to look inward at the source of the pain itself. And we have been conditioned to do just that, to look externally for our inward repose. And we don't even think. It's so obvious, isn't it, when you've done just a little bit of practice, that we've geared this thing all wrong, that we're completely disoriented to the task at hand. Isn't it so obvious? And yet, the activity continues, doesn't it? See, we haven't seen it to the depth. That's why I give this talk. Because there's more to do at this level. These are noble truths. These aren't the first thing that, they are the first thing that came out of his mouth, but they're not like the trivial, like I had a good day and desire is a cause of suffering. These are the first things that came out of his mouth because they hold his teaching. They hold his whole teaching. So that's the pain of what drives desire. It's that sense of unconscious longing. Unconscious longing. And then there's the pain of desiring itself. Desire hurts. Notice that. You know, as a monk, when things weren't immediately accessible, people had to give you things. You couldn't go reaching or go to the store. You couldn't do that. And you were to wait until somebody offered you whatever is appropriate, and their form of appropriate often didn't fit your form of appropriate. But you got it anyway, and that's what you had to deal with. Your mind goes crazy with desire. Have you ever taken yourself up on the mountain somewhere, or a trip where you've eaten freeze-dried something for a long period of time, and then your mind starts moving to what could happen at those dinners, but it's not, you know, and what you were left behind and how all of that, and that tension, how is that? What is that agitation? You know, it's fun in the desire, you see. The fantasy's fun. It's fun to play forth that fantasy because it holds a potential. And for the moment, you can actually almost believe that you're at the feast, the table, instead of eating freeze-dried food if you happen to be asleep or dreaming or something. But then the wake-up, you see, the sense of yearning itself is very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. And what you want to do is satisfy the yearning through the acquisition. But the acquisition is secondary to the end of the yearning. What we really want to do when we grasp what it is that we yearn for is the end, the agitation of the grasping itself. It's like I mentioned with the bell here. You can have an awful sitting and you keeping one eye on that bell in my hand and how close that hand is coming to the bell. And the closer it comes, the more your anticipation and agitation arouses. And finally you hear the bell and suddenly the agitation is gone. You say, oh, I could sit for an hour or more. What kept you from feeling that was the agitation of the longing. It wasn't the bad sitting. We don't see that. Or we wouldn't let a desire arise without thorough investigation, discernment. This weekend I was at Salt Spring Island, and I'm, as you have noticed, rather punctual in my actions, and we get going in the right time, we end at the right time, we just do that. But island time is not my time. And it would say it would start at 9 o'clock, and 9 o'clock would come, and I'd be all set up here, and there would be one or two people in the room. Not quite that bad, but... And the fairness arose. It's like, well, I was here. How come you're not here? And because that's not their time. It's not their time. I'm on their time. They're not on my time. And my whole equation of having all the things I was going to do in this systematic way I was going to present it and all of that fell flat because it wasn't starting on time. I was going to have to release this and give up that part of it and all of it. And so I became miserable. Because of the fairness equation. The fairness wasn't, they weren't meeting my fairness issue. Well, the second day I wised up. I said, to hell with it. just, okay, when they come, they come. I'm going to do what I can, and that's it. And it wasn't a resignation, and I got into it. I kind of liked it, actually. Where I wasn't being so anxious about when to start. It's just like when people showed up, that's when you start. But that distance between what I have and my expectations, that's where the pain and the hurt. And we perform activities to make our expectations the reality. But expectations are not the fact. So let's get this point, and this is an important one. Our fantasies are not the fact. We can have fantasies all we want, but they, unless they're oriented to the reality of the here and now, they create the agitation. They get you moving to create a new reality. That's what the agitation does. It's a motivator to get you out of here into somewhere else. But in so doing, we miss something much more profound. Because the agitation doesn't even concern itself with the now. The now is an impediment to the fulfillment of the expectation. So now is not just something I pass through, but something I abuse with my inattention. And everything that's in the now that doesn't fulfill my expectation is also abused. And I don't think abuse is a too small of a word. And then there's the peace that we find in the moment in which that acquisition is claimed, where we actually have that thing that we have been wanting. And then the agitation ends, and we think, oh, and so does the respite from the sense of self-judgment. And that's as close to heaven as we get. It doesn't get any better than this, says the beer commercial. That's as close to heaven as we get at this level of existence. So don't look for any more than that. Look for the moment, brief as it may be, because it will be brief, in which you don't have agitation and your desire has been satisfied, because that's it. And that will also be it after you die, by the way. If you're looking for heaven, what is pleasant sensations? Pleasant sensations is not going to do it for us. I'd be bored in an hour. You think the mind's going to be, the consciousness is going to work any differently there? What we have here, we're going to have there. Right? So let's sober up on this. It takes a different equation to make this thing work. Okay, what's the third pain? Is the pain of separation. The pain of separation. You see, when you really invest a lot of meaning into something like the sound of the bell, nothing else matters to you but the sound of the bell. Not really. And that investment, the whole meaningful relationship that you have to that one thing, puts everything else, the multiplicity, everything else, into the background. And you and the relationship you have with that one thing, and you can feel you separate out not only yourself, but everything from the world. Because there's only one thing that is worth paying attention to in the world. You feel that pain? And by definition, when you single out one thing, then you have one thing who's the singular outer. Rumi puts it like this. But in the world of things, there is so much counting. You may count 1,000 apples in your hand, but if you want them all, but if you want all of them to be one, you have to make applesauce. So when we pull back from everything else, because only one thing matters, only one sound in the universe, and it's not Om, it's the sound of the bell. And there's this existential quality of being isolated, in isolation, waiting for that bell. Because anytime you wait, you have to be isolated. You have to be alone and lonely and desperate. And that sense of desperation is that individual existential angst that we hold. And the two worlds then are erected. The world of my desire and all the other things and qualities that are thrown into the other world, of which I'm not really interested. And then there's self and other, and there's this and that. And there's complete disconnection from all things, because you're not interested in all things, you're interested in one thing. And that one thing hasn't even arrived yet, so you are still disconnected even from that one thing. And we wonder why we are so inwardly desperate. Can we see this? Can we notice the lacking? What motivates us? That sense of inward lacking or self, not taking it as some statement of the truth, but as a conditioned way that we have been led to believe about ourselves. To see this lacking. And to see the activity that comes from trying to correct this lacking rather than paying attention to the lacking. We have to be on to the real solution. Is to make all of this conscious and thereby no longer be driven unconsciously towards an imperfect payoff. Is there a way to satisfy the heart's longing not through seeking, but through putting down the burden? So how do we put down the burden when we feel a nagging sense of insufficiency or a desire for something? Is that we notice that as part of the completion. Completion doesn't mean that there has to be certain things here and certain things not there in order to be complete. It's complete no matter what its presentation, no matter what its packaging. Where is there completion with desire? First, we have to be aware of desire. It's just the mind trying to work its configuration of reality to suit its needs. And the only way it knows how to do it, and that's by thinking its way towards something. But is there a deeper sense of contentment and ease and stillness in us that can hold that agitation of the mind and not give ourselves over to it? And through that comes a bubbling form of joy that is not happiness, which is finding your sense of connection to your desire, but the joy of being complete at all times. That is not dependent upon the acquisition or the elimination of anything whatsoever. For we will never know ourselves as being complete individually or our minds being complete. Until we face the pain of what's driving us towards improvement. No experience denied or supported. What's wrong with just feeling the basics of this? What's wrong with saying, okay, just let me experience this thing consciously rather than unconsciously being driven by it towards an end that just creates more suffering for me. It feels as if this is a hard thing to hold, but not an impossible thing. It only feels difficult because we're so used to running from it rather than experiencing it. And when you see that the pain is not worth the payoff, and even the payoff creates the pain. Then you say, I'm sitting here, that's it. That's it. But to know the link between that agitated wanting, the driving, forceful, energetic power to look at the universe in individuated ways, in individual needs and events and experiences, to gather, to collect, to claim, to own, to acquire, to accumulate, and all of its accompanying side effects of envy and jealousy and comparison and evaluation, and the motivation of that sense of self-dislike. All of it, that package of angst and internal dismay, all of it. I do not move from. And may we all have that intention. Can we sit for a minute or two? So we have a few minutes for questions or comments, if people would like to ask anything. Yes.
Well, it just strikes me, with me too, that whenever there's a desire or wanting or any kind of mental pain, for me, it's always some kind of reaching out on that timeline.
Yes, the timeline, exactly. See, that's a very important understanding to have, that when you create desire, you're creating a future with desire. And when you have a future that's more important than the present, you're going to lose focus of the present and go with the future, because that's the promise of what the future will bring far exceeds the reality and your appraisal of what the present has. So when the timeline comes up, thought grabs desire and makes it into a pursuit. If you look at it, desire is not what's available, it's what will be available.
But it feels like two different means.
Two different yous.
Yes. Or two different beings. It's like one that sees it one way, and the other sort of knows which way, and it's like one or the other. It's not.
Let me. I'll see if I can get to what. So he says this, it feels like there's two different people having the problem here. One that responds or reacts to the desire, and one that sees the problem but is insufficiently based so that it has any, can make a change, right? And so you lose yourself over into the weight of the desiring me, even though there is some sense of knowledge about its limitation. Well, and may I say that probably most people in the room share that schizophrenia, and that is really the unfolding of wisdom. Although it's not strong enough at that point to change the nature of the activity, it's still on to something. So don't get too caught up in the two me's. Just spend more time with your eyes open, looking at the payoff and the pain of the pursuit. And that the me of the knowing will become stronger and stronger from that understanding. Yes.
I've been playing with the distinction between desire and love.
And love?
And love. Desire being the near enemy of love.
Desire being the near enemy of love.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And desire as opposed to
right.
genuine love for
right.
whatever it is that
right.
I see in front of me.
Right. So if I'm, are you talking about romance now?
No, just well, yes, but also just in terms of experience, having a wonderful experience or something like that. I notice it there too. I notice it in looking at flowers. Or
right. So you look at a flower, and what happens?
I just enjoy it.
Right. Just the joy.
I want to pick it.
Right. Good. So he says the difference between desire and love on all levels, like looking at a flower, when you can just appreciate the beauty and not want anything from it, right? So there's no... Pardon?
It's not about me.
It's not about you at all. It becomes about you when you want to pick it and take it home with you, which is painful. See, that's the pain. So you notice the pain of wanting to possess the beauty. Do you see that? And when you start looking at the pain, that's a contraction. That's a way where you want the duration of that experience to extend itself beyond your passing through the garden. So you're going to pick it and take it with you. You see? You're trying to increase your enjoyment, prolong your enjoyment. And when it becomes that, there's a contraction around the experience, and you can feel it. You want to hold on to it. That should be, you should become more and more aware of that sense of contractedness, because therein lies the activity from desire rather than the activity from love. Activity from love walks through the garden and feels the impact of everything, but doesn't retard or hasten anything. And the key to that is noticing the contractibility, how the mind lapses around it and wants to perpetuate it rather than moving on and moving through. Yes, you're right. Capture and collect. That's what the mind does. It captures and collects. It's time for one more question, if there is one. Yes.
You said something passingly last week that has stuck in my mind ever since. And I'd like to know if you could clarify a little bit. To paraphrase, you said something to the effect, we don't have time to fool around.
Right, we don't have time to fool around. He heard this last week and he would like me to say more about it. Right? We don't have time to fool around. I don't know what else to say about it. We're dying. You know that? You know you're dying? So that's a good start, to know that you don't have time to fool around. Fooling around is playing within the fields of our fantasies, wish fulfillment. This mind is, its job is to wish fulfill. And it's just living in a kind of a dream of its own wish and trying to pursue those wishes. That's what I call playing around. Waking up is completely different from that. Waking up does not pursue wish fulfillment. It abides in reality and releases itself from the need to wish anything further because it finds contentment within that reality. And so to wake up and to see how it is that we have been sleepwalking through our life. These are strong words, but not inadequate, improper words. And as we get older and older, the clock is ticking. We don't have that much more time to wake up. Because for most people, waking up requires a great deal of discernment of their experience. And unless we start taking that seriously, and not just following further wish fulfillment or playing around the edges of it. I don't know how many of you takes this seriously, because I have no way of knowing. I hand out the homework. How many of you really look at that? How many? Oh, I can do it next week, right? And how many years have I been teaching here in which you're going to do it next week? So I challenge all of us to take this seriously. Okay, good, thank you.